Hi guys, welcome to another episode of Tan Tanner. This is the first episode of 2021. Thank you so much for being here after such a long time, and joining me again really means a lot because we started this podcast only last year, and seeing people engaging with the content and giving me feedback and also participating means so much to me. So thank you for that. Also, thank you for your patience. I know it's been a long time. However, moving during a pandemic is more stressful than I thought it would be. but I mean, it all worked out in the end. So I'm back, baby. Not sure if I will be able to do weekly episodes anymore, but I will definitely try to do bi-weekly episodes. Again, regularly, and we have some awesome things planned for this year, including a new jingle, so keep an ear out for that. In this episode, we're gonna start the year easy. Like, first of all, we had a hard year, okay? I think everyone did, and we deserve a bit of just relaxation and calmness. even though I can't promise that completely, however, because you guys know me, and even when the topic is books, you know I'll get political, so I'm here with my tea, I have my books ready, and I'm ready to take you on a journey, hopefully. As I was saying, we had a very hard year, so congratulations for making it out alive and hopefully sane and healthy. And we shall get right into it. So, you requested, and I shall deliver, my top five books that I read in 2020. And actually, super funny, I think 2020 was the year, I read like 20 books in 2020, which is, hey, 20 books in 2020. didn't notice that before. Which is very special for me because ever since I started university, and also ever since depression fucked up my concentration, it's very hard for me to read, even though I love reading books, and I always had this like goal of reading 10,000 books in my lifetime, which is never gonna happen. I'm now aiming for 1,000 books, which is doable if I continue reading 16 books a year. Still a lot, but you know, we're trying to stay educated and learn new things, so yeah. So I was super proud of myself, just because it's something that was always very important to me, which doesn't mean you shouldn't be proud of yourself if you have read no books or just one or two or five. There have been years where I only read three. It's just for me a personal accomplishment, and I felt good about myself. So I'm super excited to share. I thought I read more. Oh my god, sorry. That was almost knocked something over there. Also, excuse my audio quality. I hope this is fine. I'm still waiting on my mic to arrive here. So that was also one of the reasons I was taking kind of a break, because I want to deliver the best audio quality to you that I can offer. So, but I hope this will do for now. So what was I saying? Oh yes. So I don't know why, but the amount of books I read still didn't seem that much when I was looking at the, you know, when I was going through it and I was deciding which were my favorite books of the year. But it was surprisingly easy to choose, which is usually not the case. I don't know what that, if that's a good or a bad thing, but, yeah, I guess I like what I like. Okay, this is in no particular order, because the ones that I did choose were super, all of them, I love them very much. So where should I start? Okay, I'm gonna start with a fiction book that I really liked. It's called God Dies by the Night by Nawal el-Sadawi. She's an Egyptian writer super important figure in Egypt. She is a feminist, she is a politician, she's an activist. She had run for office, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, back in the 90s, but then she was politically threatened, so she had to leave the country. So then she was in the UK, I think, or in the US. I'm not 100% sure about this anymore. Anyway, she's very impressive. Okay, so she was in Washington. She was, oh no, she was both in the US and Europe. So, yeah, she's this very impressive woman and a very witty writer. And, oh, sorry, she left in the 80s and then came back in the 90s. Very impressive, very witty. She's very intelligent, you can tell. And for her, of course, her main themes are women and women in society, their positions, etc., etc. And this, you can see this in her work, obviously. And God Dies by Denial is about, how do I even explain this? So it's about it's about a village. Like, I mean, there is a main character who is a woman, but it's mostly about the village and the characters in the village, which includes one particular family that she focuses on, and is she kind of criticizes religion and how religion is abused in rural areas, and how that changes women's position and what hardships women go through in these societies. Very, very interesting in my opinion. I'm gonna do a dramatic reading of two of my favorite passages. So the first one I thought was really funny because I'm like, men really do be like that, huh? So let me set the scene. The mayor is sitting together with three other men of the village. One is the sheikh from the mosque. One is Haji Ismail, who is the guard, like the main chief guard, I guess. And then the village barber. They're all sitting together and they see this woman walk by, who's gonna turn out to be the you know, one of the main characters. And they're looking at her, of course. And then this dialogue is happening, basically. By the way, disclaimer, I'm not a very good reader, so bear with me. The mayor pouted his fleshy lips at the sheikh of the mosque. Why had this man led the conversation away from Zainab's rosy heels to such weighty matters as religion and faith? He smiled in Haj Ismail's direction and said, "Tell me, in your capacity as doctor healer in this village, how is it possible that a dark-skinned devil like Kafrari should have fathered daughters who are as white as a bowl of cream?" Sheikh Hamzawi butted in again, attempting to chase away the image of the mayor's disapproving pout, which was still upsetting his tranquility. He intoned, "And Allah doth create from the loins of a man of God a corrupt descent." "You have not told me what you think, Haj Ismail," said the mayor, ignoring Sheikh Hamzawi's interruption. The village barber was still busy turning over in his mind the title of Doctor Healer, which the mayor had bestowed upon him. It made him feel as though he had been accorded a bachelor's degree in medicine, which put him on equal footing with any medical doctor in the area. He pulled himself up and gazed fixedly in front of him with narrowed eyes as though lost in deep thought. On his face was the look of a man of science who has penetrated into the secrets of life and is now endowed with great knowledge. I love this passage so much because this is so hilarious to me. Like, the authority the mayor has in the village. This is very realistic, by the way. I think that's why I find it so hilarious. But, like, the fact that a man calling him Dr. Healer on a whim and this man gaining so much confidence from it is absolutely hilarious to me. Like, to the point where he probably feels more valid as a doctor than he would see a female doctor, like a woman doctor. And so, I don't know, I thought this was very hilarious. And the other part that I wanted to read you guys, wow, I can't talk anymore. So this is from the perspective of the, or not from the perspective of the main character, but it's basically focusing on her inner thoughts. I think this is Zainab, if I'm not mistaken. She doesn't really use names very often. I'm not sure, but yeah, I think it's the main character, Zainab. And sorry, my cat is on my, I think he's trying to turn. What are you doing, buddy? Do you want to say hi? No, okay. He wants attention. All right. So, anyway, this is like focusing on her story now. You will understand what it's about very, very, very quickly. She did not know exactly what it was that was wrong with her, but ever since her childhood, she had felt there was something impure about her, that something in her body was unclean and bad. Then one day, Saber came to their house, and she was told that the old woman was going to cut the bad, unclean part off. She was overcome by a feeling of overwhelming happiness. She was only 6 years old at the time. After having done what she was supposed to do, Saber went away, leaving a small wound between her thighs. It continued to bleed for several days, but even after it healed, she was still left with something unclean in her body, which used to bleed for several days at a time. Each time she had her periods, the people around her would have a changed expression in their eyes when they looked at her, or they would avoid her as though there was something corrupt or bad about her. Anyway, I love this part. I think it really represents. I don't want to read more because I don't want to spoil it. But you get the idea. You get the vibe. I think I love this so much. I think I love that she's being so critical of, Muslim societies because I feel like there aren't enough books that are from the community that are critical about it. People who actually grew up in Muslim societies. El-Sadawi, she's a really, really, really important figure in general, and I recommend her reading. It's great. Even if you don't have the cultural context, I think you will understand the characters and you will feel a connection to them. Especially if you're a woman, I think. But I think everyone should read this. I think it's impeccable. It's so good. There's nothing else I have to say about this. This is number one. Number two was definitely, I think one of my favorite books I ever read in my entire life. It was a gift from my dear friend Mora, and it's called Women, Islam, and Cinema by Gunnil Dönmez Colin. Basically, the book is kind of like a research, I would say. It's about Islamic cinema in the Middle East, or specifically in Muslim communities. But she mainly focuses on Turkish and Persian cinema. For me personally, obviously, this book was super interesting because as someone who grew up away from Turkey, I don't have that much connection to Turkish cinema. I mean, I know it, however, I don't have as much knowledge as I wish I had. So this was really cool to dive into. She discusses. You can see a theme here, right? Like, I am very interested in women in society because basically she's just discussing about the roles that women played in the movies, what women filmmakers made, what male filmmakers made, what kind of roles actresses had to decline or had mostly to play, and she also discusses themes in these movies, like stereotypes, specific like cultural elements. I really liked it. It was very informative. And even if you don't really have, again, the background for it, it's still very comprehensible. She explains everything very detailed. Even as an outsider, you will understand what is going on. And I also have some quotes from this one. Very interesting, because I didn't know this. So this is like pretty much in the beginning of the book where she talks about the history of cinema in Turkey. And it goes, historical investigations reveal remarkable transnational elements in which the way cinema has evolved in these Muslim countries, where it generally began as entertainment for men by men. Turkish women are said to have donned male clothing or dressed as Christians to accompany men into the cinema halls. In 1909, armed fundamentalists occupied a theater, threatening to knife any woman who dared to set foot inside. Special screenings were arranged for women on certain days of the week, and some cinemas divided the halls with a wooden board into haremlik and selamlik, women on one side and men on the other. According to the memoirs of a cinema owner, Kemal Atatürk was not happy when he noticed that the Ankara theater where he went to see a film was filled with men, while the large crowd of women who cheered him outside was barred from entering. He ordered his aide to let in all the women. The film could not start because of the long applause from the women, and that is how the first non-segregated film was watched, in the presence of the leader himself. If you don't know Kemal Atatürk, I think she does mention him in the beginning, but he's basically the founding father of democratic Turkey, because he introduced democracy and he got rid of the is it called caliphate in English? I don't think so. But of the sultans. He got rid of the sultans and he established democracy, etc. And he is definitely not a saint. He did a lot of things wrong. But one thing that I will give this man is that he actually fought for equal rights for women all the time, like until the day he died. And apparently he did this too, which is pretty cool. What else? Oh, yeah, here's one of the stereotypes she's discussing. So, family is pivotal to films from most Muslim countries, often as a microcosm of the social system, and is instrumental in creating a national identity. Family also functions as a mechanism to merge religious, social, and political values through the representation of women in roles defined by their relationship with male figures. Where was it? Oh, yeah. So there is a quote by Ali Özgen Türk, who was apparently a prominent voice from the middle generation in Turkish cinema, who said, who defined Turkish cinema as essentially a Muslim cinema that preserves in its subconscious the residues of the Ottoman culture, the foundation of the present Turkish society. Women are defined as good or bad through their sexuality. Bad woman makes love, good woman gets married. Good woman is an innocent, asexual icon who does not live. Bad woman's fate is bars and brothels. The language of the body is the language of Islam. She criticizes basically that male visual pleasure is the controlling pleasure, which is pretty true. I don't think this is only true for Turkish cinema, but yeah, still pretty interesting to know. There's one part where she talks about the prostitutes in movies, and she says, although they, the prostitutes, are not responsible for their misfortune, they must die to save society, because sexually experienced single women are a threat to the integrity of men and the durability of marriage. And they're usually considered fallen women, which is interesting. I only have two more quotes, I think. Okay, here we go. In the 1980s, more women joined the workforce and their new experiences posed a challenge to the traditional family values, disrupting the patriarchal order. For some women, economic independence was an open door to escape male oppression and to take control of their own lives. However, the appearance of the working woman did not automatically free cinema from the status quo. And she goes on to say that women were expected to serve society as teachers, nurses, bank clerks, secretaries, or housemates. Cinema marginalized women by creating characters whose sexual behavior drastically deviated from the established norms. Women filmmakers fell into the same trap and showed women in powerful positions, relegating this power without much fight to the man they love and becoming slaves to uncontrollable male desires. The focus of these films was not the career of the woman, but her achievements regarding the opposite sex. Dun, dun, dun. And the last thing. I think this is from like early to. Like this is end 1990s, beginning 2000s, where she talks about how cinema is evolving. In terms of gender issues. Oh my god, I hope you didn't hear that. Sorry, that was my laptop. In terms of gender issues, however, a masculinist approach prevails. Women are portrayed as level-headed, but at the same time as sweet trouble for men. Men-woman relations are framed within their traditional boundaries, men as the artist, woman as the muse. Women seeking marriage and stability, men searching for new experiences. Middle-aged men with no particular sex appeal, apart from the unwritten law of the superiority of his gender seducing a beautiful young woman. I thought that was so funny. Anyway, I hope that convinces you to find this book. I know that it's probably harder to find than the other one that I talked about before, but it's really worth it. Maybe there is a PDF online. I am not sure, but I highly, highly, highly recommend this book if you're into movies and feminism. I think this is pretty cool. Then let's see. Okay, let's go with another fiction book. This is called My Cat Yugoslavia, and it's by Pajdem Statovci, I think. I hope so. And this is actually the only male writer that I read last year. No, I did read James Baldwin's novel. However, apart from that, he's the only man I read last year, I think. And honestly, never would have thought a man could write a woman's perspective so well. Like, it is really, really, really well written, and this is now also one of my favorite books in my life, I think. So what is this about? I don't even know how to summarize this. It's not, the title is kind of misleading. There is not a cat named Yugoslavia. Not really. But it's basically about immigrants from the Balkans arriving in Finland, if I'm not mistaken. I have such a shitty memory. I am so sorry. But it jumps back and forth between the perspective of the son at the current time and the perspective of the mother from when she was still living in Yugoslavia. And very interesting back and forth. I loved it. It's really, the characters are very interesting. The thought processes are described very detailed, but without it being boring. And it's just very relatable to me. I don't know, and whenever I was I was reading it, and I was like, holy shit, like, I mean, I'm not from the Balkans, but, like, very similar culture, and also just the experience of as being an immigrant child, this really resonated with me, and that's probably why I love it so much. And yeah, let me read you some passages. So this is from, so in the beginning of the chapter, it also indicates the time, like when it's from the perspective of the mother, it indicates the time. So here it says spring 1980. So this is from the perspective of the mother when she was still a child. And it goes, when I realized the only reason I went to school in the first place was because an illiterate woman had no chance of marrying a decent husband, the bile rose up to the back of my throat and my food no longer tasted of anything. And when I realized my life would be no more extraordinary, even if I got top grades in all my subjects, I started to feel physically ill. I'd never heard of a single female politician, a female teacher or lawyer. I realized and I gripped the edge of the table and took deep breaths through my nose. I shook my head and began wondering what I could hope for instead of dreams. Getting goosebumps from this. I love this book so much. Okay, and to give you also a perspective of the, you know, the other chapters where it's from the perspective of the son who's now living his life as a university student. Immigrants have to grow a thick skin if they want to do something more than wait hand and foot on the fence, my father used to say. Go ahead, do as they do. Ruin your life by being like them, but one day you'll see that if you try to become their equal, they'll despise you all the more, and then you'll end up hating yourself. Don't give them the satisfaction. I'll only tell you this once. Never try to be better than them. And a bit later it says, they even asked me about it, they being the Finns. When are immigrants going to get off their asses and do something? When are they going to stop shafting the welfare system, lazing about and harassing women? Sure, they're not all the same. Like you, I mean, you're an exception. You're just the kind of immigrant we welcome here. But most of them, And this just resonated with me so much because my teacher called me an exception when he said that Turkish people are dumb. So, yeah, I just really love this book. I don't want to spoil it too much, so I'm not going to read as much about it, but it's just very, it's very interesting, and it kind of shows also generational trauma, which I think is really interesting, and it was just very captivating, and I never wanted it to end. I wish there was a second book coming out of this, but I know it's not gonna. But I loved it very much, and I can only recommend it if you're in the mood for some very real fiction. yeah. This one. Then the last book I finished was Cards at Midnight, Fashion and Body Politics in Imperial Sudan. Also very interesting book. This is, again, a nonfiction book. It's about, well, as the title says, it's about the the time that Britain and Egypt invaded Sudan, mostly focusing on British policies, though, because they had more power within Sudan, as far as I understood from the book. However, I'm not very educated on the topic as a whole, so I take my word with a bit of, with a salt of grain. A grain of salt? A grain of salt. Wow, I cannot talk anymore. basically, this is from Mary Grace Brown. Mary Grace Brown, she's talking about how women moved through the imperial state. So during the colonization times, how did women get to be inside the home, outside the home? How was fashion linked to politics? Which is also super interesting because apparently, so the whole premise of the reason this book was written and why she did her research was because the clothing item in Sudan, the taupe, had very specific names, like. Okay, maybe I'm not explaining this very correctly, but a different style of taupe would be named according to the political current situations, and women chose to represent them, you know, represent these political situations through choosing to buy these specific garments, and these specific tobes that were named after them, and they were kind of representing their own political opinion in that way. And the tobe also allowed them to leave their homes and be more out in public, for example. And that's one of the points that Mary Grace Brown is making in the book, that it allowed them to have more agency, and also at the end of the day, gain political agency as well, and be more actively involved within politics. Very, very cool. Like, I really, this, by the way, focuses on northern Sudan, because, you know, Sudan unfortunately split, back in 2011, if I remember correctly. She also talks about how the colonization had an impact on women's bodies directly, not only in the fabric that they were wearing, but, on old body traditions as well, such as genital mutilation or scarring, or whatever, also painting, I think. So piercings, all of this had an impact on women's bodies, and she's basically exploring, how the imperialists rule can be read through what women's bodies went through during time. And what I also have some excerpts on this, because women, they have minds. I just love reading this. Like, this was so interesting to me because I unfortunately don't know that much about the history of Sudan, or in general that region in general, like, because I never learned anything about it, so I tried to, it was just very, very interesting to learn a lot about this, and I can only recommend it if you're into that sort of thing. All right, so this is from the very beginning,
First, this is from the introduction chapter. Fashion, like the body, is an indicator of self and place. As an extension of the body's surface, clothing conveys status, values, and belonging. But fabric is more fluid than flesh. As a result, clothing styles and adornment are far more adaptive and responsive to rapid social and political change. That was basic. Like, you can see what she's interested in. I think it's very clear from that.
And she also quickly establishes that the imperial rule didn't really have a lot of benefits for Sudan itself. Of course, because it's colonization. And it's also in the first chapter. She establishes the British conquest of Sudan was part of an imperial program. The territory was held to secure British interests in Egypt and the Suez Canal and as a bulwark against French encroachment across the rest of Africa. Local subsistence farming was overturned in favor of large-scale cotton crop production to supply Lancashire mills. And imported cultural standards of Victorian morality and civility were used as a measure of whether Sudan was politically ready for modern statehood. Most critically, the intentionally divisive policies employed by British administrators in northern and southern Sudan laid the groundwork for 50 years of civil war after the country's independence and the eventual secession of South Sudan in 2011. So thanks for nothing, Britain. What the fuck? All right, there was one part I really liked. This is super interesting because she also reports on very prominent political, like, women political figures later on that kind of started, like, in the 40s and, like, 30s, 40s, I would say, kind of started coming up, and then they started really being involved throughout the mid 20th century. And this is a part of that. I just really love this passage, so I'm gonna read it to you. So it's like ingrained in your mind, even if you don't read the whole book. This is the part where I was like, yeehaw, my guy, I love this. Okay, let me try. Nafisa Ahmed remembers the contradictory aim to move gradually but fast. Many considered it shameful to openly discuss women's body rights, especially as they're related to sex and reproduction. This need for discretion meant that activists could not man public campaigns against body traditions. Instead, night schools, housewife associations, and girl guide meetings became the sites of reformist lessons and instruction. Even the semi-public location of these discussions created meaning. In traveling to class or meeting, the modern woman distanced herself from the harmful behaviors that rooted her in her home in the past. Activism itself suggested a new type of community and belonging that was not directly tied to bodies. It offered solutions to women's problems that were structural rather than individual. In a 1988 interview, Fatima Ahmed Ibrahim recalled the Zar ceremony, which is a ceremony that was done to repel a demon within a woman's body. Gave women a false sense of being helped when only a socialist revolution would change their condition, not Tsar-type collective therapy. From a modernist standpoint, the Tsar drawings that have been traditionally used to address infertility, illness, depression, and marital strife were a misuse of women's energy. Real improvements in women's lives were only possible through sustained social and political action. Civic engagement and eventual full citizenship were intended to replace the Tsar's collective therapy in sustaining Sudanese women. In effect, Fatima Ahmed and her peers represented a new form of women's collective, one that was united by ideas, not kinship or bodily practices, and one that sought reform at a societal rather than individual level. I love that.
For them, like, this is amazing. I love women. They're so smart. I think Fatima Ahmed Ibrahim, she has a book as well, and I put it, like, there is a book about her. I put it on my to-read list because she is mentioned quite often throughout the book, and she's pretty cool. She's, I think, if I remember correctly, one of the people who first contacted, like, newspapers to speak out about inadequacy of girls' education, and I think she also formed the SWU, which is, like, the Sudanese Women's Union, I think. I think she was one of the founders, if I remember correctly. And I think they also started a magazine about women's issues. The Woman's Voice, yeah. And yeah, here you go. In 1954, Fatima Ahmed Ibrahim founded a monthly women's magazine, The Woman's Voice. I'm not going to torture you with my terrible Arabic. So, yeah, she's super cool. And I learned a lot in this book. I love that. I also love that she is really trying, like the author is really trying to find a balance between, you know, seeing the pros and cons of the fashion statements. She's also, for example, talking about how these women's activists, they knew that they had to, you know, relate to, they kind of had to stay grounded to their roots. And so them wearing the taupe was actually part of their campaign, because they, in this way, they could say, like, look, I'm wearing the taupe. This is our national garments. This is what we're wearing. This is part of our culture, our traditions, and which means feminism is also part of our, or it should be part of our cultures and traditions. It's not counterculture, basically. They were trying to appeal to the masses by saying, us wanting rights has nothing to do with the West. It has to do with the fact that it comes natural to us because it is part of our society, or it should be at least. And for them, maintaining that part of their cultural identity helped them be taken more seriously and being regarded with more respect in that matter. Does that make sense? I hope it makes sense. They also talk about how she doesn't really go into it that much because I feel like that would be a whole other topic, but she'll, of course, there's a divide between South Sudan and North Sudan on this matter. Like, South Sudan isn't, yeah, they're not, they have a more, like, I guess, cultural variety. I don't know if that's the right word, but so for them, for example, the taupe doesn't resonate with them the same way it does in Northern Sudan. And that's also, obviously, that's part of why there was such a huge, there was just huge trouble culturally between the regions, unfortunately. Again, thanks to the Brits. Thanks for that. But anyway, like, I really like this book. I think because it's Stanford University Press, so it's quite expensive. If you can get it secondhand, I would recommend you getting it secondhand, or maybe you can find it online. I don't know, but it's very, very interesting. If you want to lend it, let me know. Maybe I can get it to you somehow. Like, I don't mind at all. I did write in the front, because I do this now. Every time I finish a book, I try to write down some of my thoughts in the beginning. I don't know why. I feel like it's like leaving part of myself in the book, I guess. I wrote here,
I have said this before and I will say it again. Women are at the forefront of every revolution, every rebellion, every act against authority and regime, because we always had to fight for our place in the world. And this book just confirmed that even more. And
I love the sisterhood in this. I love the effort. I also really find it very interesting because body politics is something that really, really I started getting into, I think, last year. Well, no, now it's already 2 years ago, 2019. I can recommend that book. I can recommend this book if you're also interested in that. And the last book I wanted to recommend was Matilda by Mary Wollstonecraft. I still recommend it. It's a very short book, but I love it. However, I had lent it from my dear friend Maura, so I have nothing to read from it or, like, recall from it. I just remember I really liked it. I think it's gothic horror, if I remember correctly. And it's like, we all have daddy issues, don't we? That's the book summarized. I can recommend it. It's a fun read. It's a fun short read. However, because I did read from all of these, I still wanted to have a fifth book that I read from, and So I picked up Virginia Woolf's Orlando. I did not read this in 2020. I read this in December 2019. However, I'll let this one slide. It counts for the sake of, you know, embarrassing myself by reading five books for the mic. But I am not going to read that much from this one because I think it would spoil too much. But, I mean, to just sum it up, it's about Orlando, who's a passionate young man. And he basically kind of lives through the centuries. It's very interesting because, like, he doesn't age like a normal person. Like, he lives for a very long time in different eras as different people, but still the same. And, yes. I just picked out one from the first chapter that I found pretty beautiful, so that I'm not spoiling too much. He sighed profoundly and flung himself. There was a passion in his movement, which deserves the word, on the earth at the foot of the oak tree. He loved, beneath all the summer transience,
to feel the earth spine beneath him. For such he took the heart root of the oak tree to be, or, for image followed image, it was the back of a great horse that he was riding, or the deck of a tumbling ship. It was anything indeed, so long as it was hard, for he felt the need of something which he could attach his floating heart to. The heart that tugged at his side, the heart that seemed filled with spiced and amorous gales every evening about this time when he walked out. To the oak tree he tied it, and as he lay there, gradually the flutter in and about him stilled itself. The little leaves hung, the deer stopped, the pale summer clouds stayed. His limbs grew heavy on the ground, and he lay so still that by degrees the deer stepped nearer, and the rooks wheeled around him, and the swallows dipped and circled. And the dragonflies shot past, as if all the fertility and amorous activity of a summer's evening were woven web-like about his body. I don't think I have to say anything about this. Virginia Woolf just writes gorgeous, gorgeous books. I really like this one. And the reason I picked this one, actually, is I wrote something in the front of this one as well. And I was surprised. This is when I opened this and I read this. So I thought it deserved to be on this list. So I wrote, even though there are forces in our lives we cannot control, it's what we do with the rest that matters. We all write our own stories. In a world full of compliance and silent obedience, being yourself is an act of bravery. Choose to be brave and live freely. December 2019. I love her. I want to read more of her books, but... have a time. Also can highly recommend. I hope this list is giving you some inspiration, and I hope you found something that is interesting.
Thank you for staying with me through my stumbling words. I'm not really good at reading out loud. I don't know why. But yeah, thank you so much for staying with me. And let me know if have you read any of these books? If yes, did you like them? Or did you not like them? Why not? Did you put anything on your list from my book list? Are you looking forward to read something? Is there any book that I should read next? Please let me know. Like, I'm always open for book recommendations. I already have, like, over 900 books on my to-read list, but I am not scared. I am not afraid to add more. So, if you have anything that you feel like I might like, please let me know. And, I hope I was able to recommend something that has awoken your interest. That's it for today. I am looking forward to hearing from you guys. And maybe hear from you next week. And if not, definitely the week after. In the meantime, take good care, stay safe, stay hydrated, wear your mask, and love you very much. Bye!